Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Today my guest is Greg Wilpert. Greg has been on before. It's been a number of weeks, but it's great to have Greg back. For those of you who don't know him, let me explain that for 8 years he lived in Venezuela. He knows the country well, for certain. He's a PhD sociologist, a freelance journalist, a former Fulbright scholar, and he's the current editor of the best website by far I know on Venezuela. Can't imagine any that can match it for the content that Greg gets up on it. It's called VenezuelaAnalysis.com. I recommend that listeners check it out, along with the one that makes this program possible, GlobalResearch.ca. Greg's site really covers, it's an in-depth account of what's going on in Venezuela. It provides in-depth analysis, developments of the country, the latest news, the most important things that people want to know about if they want to keep track of Venezuela. And they should, because it's a country very different than most others, certainly a lot different from the way things are run here in the U.S. Greg knows it very well. We'll talk about recent developments. There were regional elections held on November 23rd. It was a powerful endorsement for the Chavez agenda, called Bolivarianism. It's certainly what I call it. It's not perfect. There is no government on this planet that's perfect. But Chavez has really transformed the country since he was elected in 1998, took office in February 1999. It's approaching 10 years. And we can get into what he hopes he'll be able to continue in the future. But, Greg, welcome to the program. That's a long introduction.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's terrific having you back on again. And a gloomy day in Chicago, where I live. I'm not certain if it's going to snow or what, but it's a good day to keep off the streets, I think. We'll take a break in about a minute or so. Before we get into current events, can I mention your book? And maybe when we come back, we can talk just very briefly about it. We did it last time. But you wrote an important book in the country called Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. It's an important book to read to know about what's going on in Venezuela. And you know it well because you spent 8 years getting to know it, learning about it, and so on. And it's very easy to find your book. Just go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and you can get information about it. You can read a little summary of what you cover. And, Greg, you want to say a few words? Just kick it off, and as soon as we come back from break, maybe cover a little more, then we'll get into current goings-on in the country.
Sure. It was published last year by Verso Books, and the basic idea was to come out with something that would give people a good overview, not just historical, as to the Chavez presidency, because there's been several books on that, but to also give them a good idea as to what actually the Chavez government has done since it came into office, and also to then relate it to ideas about 21st century socialism.
And Chavez's party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, I don't think listeners to this program, Greg, but I think most people in the U.S. would be frightened when they hear the word socialist. Well, I think of it as not perfect, but it's a participatory democracy with a very powerful figure at its head, maybe in some people's eyes bigger than life. That music signals a break. Let's go ahead and take it, Greg, and then we'll be back and pick it up. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. I'm on with Greg Wilpert. Greg is the editor of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And, again, Greg, it's great having you on. We were talking briefly about your book, Changing Venezuela by Taking Power. It was a sea change when Chavez came in, just so different than what had gone on for generations before him. But talk a little bit about more about what you wrote about in your book.
Yeah, that's actually a good place to start, is to make the contrast with, what happened in Venezuela before, because most people, they just hear about Venezuela kind of in the abstract without having a clear understanding as to what Venezuela was like before Chavez was elected. So I think it's always important to make that comparison. And so there you always have to start with an understanding that Venezuela, even though it has one of the largest oil reserves in the world, was actually in a very, very unequal country with a poverty rate of over 50% when Chavez came into office, and a political system that was really ossified with a political elite that had a stranglehold on the government, and actually was quite, some would say, quite repressive, actually, because demonstrations were regularly prohibited and broken up with violently by the police forces. As a matter of fact, you know, in 1989, there was a very, you know, famous incident when people rioted and the military and the police killed anywhere between 300 and 1,000 people. So one has to understand, you know, this is, you know, where Venezuela comes from, and people elected Chavez because he said he wanted to create a revolution in Venezuela. I mean, he was very clear about that, wanted to completely revolutionize the country, and by that he meant basically to get rid of that old political elite. I mean, he wasn't talking about an economic revolution at the time, that is, you know, 10 years ago in 1998 when he first got elected. So almost exactly 10 years ago, as a matter of fact, December 6, 1998, he was first elected with, you know, something like 56% of the vote. And part of the reason, you know, he got such a high percentage of the vote was precisely because people were so sick and tired of that old political elite. And since then, you know, he really changed the country and turned it into a country that is much more democratic, I would argue, contrary to what most people hear about Venezuela. And and since then, though, he's also taken up more of a progressive economic program, especially since, I would say, since 2005. Well, already before that, but it's, you know, become progressively or more radical in many ways, where he's basically said that we have to introduce economic democracy and try to, you know, support cooperatives and worker-managed factories and things like that, and a very strong land reform, and lots of social programs that redistribute the country's wealth to the country's poor. And as a result, poverty has declined quite significantly. It is now closer to 20% of the population instead of 50%. So it's gone down. It's been more than halved in those 10 years. And, you know, they've done a massive investment in education, tripling the education budget. I mentioned already the land reform program, where they've redistributed agricultural land to over 200,000 families. So it's really quite a lot has happened that most people really never hear about. They hear only about Chavez's rhetoric, which is, you know, quite over the top, and he's always lambasting, you know, the U.S. government and particularly, you know, President Bush.
I love it, Greg. he may be over the top, but there's nobody who does it like he does. And right. I make a confession. I honest to God love it. But go on.
Yeah, but that gets all the attention, is, you know, Chavez's you know, talk, but the actions of what actually is happening on the ground in Venezuela rarely gets any attention. And then the only time that, you know, Venezuela does get into the news is when, for example, the TV station that helped organize a coup attempt against Chavez in 2002, when they don't get their broadcast license renewed, which is, of course, something that no country in the world would do. But in Venezuela, it's the international media interpreted as if it was, you know, something to an effort to stifle freedom of the press, which is kind of quite ridiculous considering just how free the press is in Venezuela, mostly still privately owned, and it's extremely opposition-oriented. So,
and the country is also very, very, very hospitable to business, where the dominant media tries to portray Chavez as very anti-business. He really isn't anti-business. Industries have been nationalized, but so aren't they in lots of other countries around the world, especially the oil industry. I think it's more common to have the oil industry nationalized in many countries than to have it privately owned. But we only complain about the countries like run by Democrats that don't want to send their wealth up north to let U.S. corporations benefit from it, but as you say, want to redistribute a good portion of the nation's wealth to the people who need it most, keep it at home, and give it to the needy people. And he's done wonders. One other comment, Greg. I was so struck way back in thinking that, my goodness, here's a politician who made promises and actually kept them. I can't think of another politician who did that.
Right. I mean, that really makes Chavez almost unique. It's pretty amazing. And I think, you know, and the weird thing is when Chavez first got elected, the country's old elite basically assumed he would be a typical politician. And so he got the support of some of that old elite. But once he was in office, he then, you know, actually started implementing it, and they turned against him, even though he was just sticking to his campaign promises. But they, you know, they turned against him because they thought that they would be able to co-opt him, but they weren't. And so I think that really makes up, is really the main reason why Chavez is so popular, is precisely because he says what he does. He does what he says he will do.
I remember when he was reelected in 2006, December 2006, and it was astonishing. Out of curiosity, I did some checking, and I discovered that his landslide, about 63% of the vote, was a greater landslide victory than any U.S. presidential election in history once they became competitive after around 1820. Washington ran unopposed, so he was coronated. He wasn't elected. And I think James Monroe was the last one who had a competitor, but not really much competition. It was a fading party, and he got about 80% of the vote. But after that, there were competitive elections, and the greatest landslides in U.S. history were not as great as the landslide victory that Chavez won. And I said, oh, my goodness, that would make a terrific article.
Right. So the same thing goes for Venezuelan history. It was the biggest landslide in Venezuelan history as well.
I would imagine. Setting aside ones that may have been arranged to be the kind of landslides that you know about in advance before the votes are cast, or really, in fact, the percentage of the vote that actually was cast. Am I saying that right? In other words, lots of elections are arranged to come out a certain way. When Saddam ran elections, he would get, 98% of the vote?
All right. Yeah.
Those elections aside, in elections where people actually voted and their votes were cast, Chavez won the biggest election victory in Venezuelan history.
Right. Well, since 1958, there have been competitive elections. The candidates were always restricted in terms of, you know, that nobody who didn't belong to one of the two major parties was able to really run. But they had two parties always, and they were very tight. And then, actually, the last election before Chavez, there were four major candidates, and the winning candidate got only about 35% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
a little bit like what may go on here occasionally, although right. Now the alternative party candidates in the U.S. have really been virtually wiped out. They just don't seem to have a chance. But I remember Bill Clinton, the two elections he won, he got less than 50% of the vote. And I remember reading something that, he was so upset by that he couldn't even win a majority.
Yeah.
But Chavez is overwhelmingly supported, and it certainly showed up in the regional elections that took place in November, where the U.S. media made it seem as though the opposition made great inroads. And we can talk about the election, Greg, but they were held on November 23rd, and I'm just looking on my desktop. 5,000 candidates, 603 races, 22 state governors, 328 mayors, 233 state legislative council members, 13 Caracas Metropolitan Area Council members and a couple of others, seven others. And Chavez candidates, his party candidates, won an overwhelming victory. There was an unprecedented turnout for, I guess you would call it an off-year election, not a presidential election, 65%. And Chavez's party, the PSUV, Socialist Party, won 77% of the governor races, 81% of the mayoral races, 77% of all the contests, 58% of the popular vote, and the U.S. media made it out to seem as though the opposition made big inroads. It's right, astonishing the way they can turn facts on their head.
Yes, absolutely. This was, by any measure, this was, you know, a tremendous victory for Chavez's party and for Chavez. The only thing that I would say is that indeed Chavez didn't get just as high a vote in this vote, or his candidates didn't get as high a percentage of the vote as he got when he got reelected, which was 63%. But that's normal.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, let's
come back.
Who was running.
Let's come back to that, Greg, as soon as we come back from break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. I'm on with Greg Wilpert of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And we started getting into the regional elections, Greg. They're so different in Venezuela than here. They really are democratic elections. I know one comparison that strikes me so greatly is that in the Constitution, number one, you've got one law that governs the whole country. U.S. election law is not that way. Basically, each state can arrange its own electoral procedure, so you could have 50 different procedures as opposed to one standard uniform one. It can be very, very unfair. Now, there are some things that can't go on that used to, so-called Jim Crow laws, at least officially, but in fact they do go on. So in Venezuela, the Constitution mandates that all Venezuelans can be registered at birth, and they're allowed to vote when they become of age. In the U.S., it's not that way. You've got to register, and I've written about how the elections up here are very, very deeply corrupted. There's no question that the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections were stolen, very, very carefully documented. And one of the professors from New York University, Mark Crispin Miller, he's been on my program twice talking about the shenanigans that went on. Really incredible. They really are free, open, and fair in Venezuela, and you have monitors that come in from around the world, independent monitors from Europe, from Latin America, and they come in and they make glorious comments after the election to indicate how free, open, and fair they were, and efficient. There are no monitors in the U.S., and I just can't imagine any showing up or that would ever allow independent ones to come in. Maybe Republicans post their own monitors, Greg, and Democrats post their own, and they simply don't comment about all the shenanigans that go on. But voter rolls are stripped. This is just routine practice now. Your electronic voting machines, which I honestly wish you didn't have, I wish you had paper ballots because that's the best way to do it, counted and you've got them and so on. But your machines have verifiable receipts. The ones used right here in most states do not. So you can cast a vote for candidate A and candidate B can get it, or maybe candidate B will get two votes. And big corporations own, operate, and run these machines. It's a setup for a really corrupted election, but you don't hold them that way in Venezuela.
No, the Venezuelan system is really a model, has become a model for other countries because even though they use computers and people are suspicious about the computers. Like you say, they print out a ballot, but not only that, there's so many safety features built in, it's ridiculous. For example, First of all, the software is open source software, and everybody can look at it and examine it. It has then various other safety features that computer scientists know understand perhaps better, but where they develop a a software signature, which makes it basically impossible to modify the signature once it has been, the software. It's almost impossible to modify once it's been programmed, and every step of the way is observed by election observers. And the reason, though, that they use machines is, has something to do with Venezuelan history. And it was actually before Chavez got elected that they mandated the use of machines because the system had become so corrupt. That is, they were using paper ballots, but it was easy to manipulate them if you had, the small parties didn't have control. You couldn't have observers everywhere in all parts of the country. And so what the two dominant parties used to do is that they would set up their own observers and they would collaborate and say, okay, we're going to split the votes of the small parties equally amongst ourselves. And so, you'd have this paper ballot count and they would say, okay, this is one for the Communist Party, you get that one, and the next one for the Communist Party, the other party gets, and so on. They divide evenly the small party votes. And so it was impossible for challengers to get in on this and to control this because they couldn't possibly have observers everywhere in the country. And so the solution was to have a computerized system that would act as a control on that. In other words, the computerized system would make sure it would develop a separate count from the hand count that was also developed of the paper ballots. And so it's an additional security measure. So because all of the about 50% of the paper ballots are actually counted in Venezuela to make sure that it coincides with, and they're randomly selected, those paper ballots, which ballot boxes are actually counted. And so that way you have an independent, separate control to make sure that the machine count and the paper count are the same. So it's really an additional security measure that I fully support because of that. Because paper ballots by themselves are not that secure if you don't have observers in all polling booths, which small parties cannot do.
Oh, Greg, I agree with you. If a dominant party or a dominant group wants to arrange an outcome of election, they sure can do it, and they can do it with paper ballots. I guess they can do it with machines. But if there's an independent monitoring group, if there are outside monitors to come in, if all the things you just described are in place, that's the surest way to have a democratic election. So your electronic voting machines really do what they're supposed to do, as opposed to up here where they absolutely do not do what they're supposed to do.
No, I mean, here in the United States, the machines, they're not auditable. They don't, a huge proportion of them don't give printed ballots. And even if they do give printed ballots, those ballots only get counted if there is a suspicion of an inconsistency. So whereas in Venezuela, they automatically count 50% of the ballot boxes by hand. So in other words, if you don't find out about the cheating in the U.S., then you wouldn't even, if you don't have a reason to be suspicious, then you need the...
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm Steve Lenman. I'm on with Greg Wilpert of Venezuela Analysis. Greg, before we get back to the elections, I just got my daily Venezuela Information Office update. The first item is glorious. It has a picture of Chavez with Ingrid Betancourt. If listeners don't know who she is, she's a former Colombian, the country of Colombia, Colombian politician, former senator, and she was a long-held hostage by the FARC EP. Well, Chavez was very instrumental in gaining her release. And she says, they quote her, she says, "We owe the first step to President Chavez for gaining her release." And she goes on to say, this brings tears to my eyes. She says that she wants to thank President Chavez personally for his commitment, his generosity, his love, his care, and all that he invested in working to achieve our liberation. And, of course, Greg, as you know and I know, you know it better than I do, but I know it as well, that all the time that he was trying to an intermediary to help negotiate the release of hostages, the Colombian president Uribe and the Bush administration, behind the scenes, were doing everything possible to undermine him. Number one, because they don't want him to get any credit for anything that may go on there. And still he got some hostages released, including Ingrid Betancourt, a very big one.
Yeah, I mean, what they did was, Chavez had played a really an important role in the whole process of releasing those hostages, even though it didn't become that well known. But, he was acting as a mediator, and the FARC didn't want to deal with anybody else, really. And so it was really thanks to him, and I would say Senator Piedad Cordova of Colombia, any kind of movement happened in terms of releasing some. Of course, Ingrid Betancourt herself ended up being released through a kind of a hostage rescue operation that was independent of that. Chavez kept a lot of attention on her case as well, which I think forced, to some extent, the Colombian government to act.
She speaks of her indebtedness to Chavez for taking the first step, which he did. And, of course, the FARC didn't want to negotiate with the Colombian government. They're so devious. Alvaro Uribe, he's pretty extremist politician, pretty fascist government that he runs, which makes him a close ally of George Bush. And there's no way that that there'd be any justice for people that he would get himself involved in. And of course, a great deal of what would go on would come from direction from Washington. Again, they did all they could to undermine Chavez, and yet he still had some achievements that either weren't mentioned or were greatly played down or distorted in the U.S. media. I assume the dominant media in Venezuela as well, Greg.
Yes, definitely. The Venezuelan private media is constantly trying to undermine anything that the Chavez government does. I mean, the same way that the international media has been doing.
Let's get back to the elections. One other thing that is up on Venezuela analysis now in the last couple of days or so is that the National Assembly will take a vote and most certainly will authorize a referendum so that people can vote on whether they want to allow Chavez to run for a third term as president. The Constitution says two terms. It would need to be a change, and the people can take action through a national referendum. That's one of the ways to change the electoral law for presidents. So apparently there will be a national referendum, and I guess we'll have to wait to watch for the outcome, Greg, but I would imagine Chavez will win that referendum.
Well, there has to be a referendum in any case. The Constitution cannot be changed without a referendum. So that's very important to note. In contrast to, let's say, for example, New York City, they had a referendum on whether or not there would be term limits for the mayor, and it passed, and now the current mayor is undermining that vote by having the city assembly nullify that vote, which is really quite amazing. And the New York Times was supporting the whole process, in favor of Mayor Bloomberg, whereas at the same time, the New York Times editorial board has been lambasting Chavez for trying to do the same thing, except that Chavez wants to do it with a referendum. I mean, the double standards are just amazing. Not only that, Uribe is also seeking a third term, and this doesn't get mentioned at all in the international media, but Chavez's effort is being portrayed as some dictatorial move. And one of the arguments in both the Venezuelan media and also here has been that, last year there was an effort to change the Constitution. And one of the 69 articles that was proposed in this reform was to get rid of the term limit. And that referendum lost very narrowly. That is, Chavez's proposal for reforming the Constitution lost by, just a fraction of a percentage point. But and now they're saying that, you cannot propose the same change again. But it's not the same change. It's only one article, not 69 articles that they're proposing. So it's kind of ridiculous. And the Constitution is very clear about this. It says you cannot propose the same reform again in the same legislative period. But it's not the same reform. It's just one amendment, one article, not 69 articles.
And you're talking about the reform referendum last December,
right,
that very narrowly went down to defeat. And I don't know what your thought about it is. I read a couple of things that seemed to hint that Chavez really won, but it was so close he decided he would just let it go because for certain he'd be accused of electoral theft if he won by 50.3 to 49.7 or something or other.
Right.
So he just decided he would fight that battle another time in another way. Any credence to that argument?
Actually, I think so, because of the National Electoral Council, you know, was never really published the final result. And I think that the reason that they didn't is because the more results that kept coming in, they kept coming in favor of the support for the reform. So it's, I think it's very likely that actually that it won by a fraction of a percentage, but everybody agreed that it would be a disaster for the country if it would win by such a narrow margin, and they'd rather just skip it and let it lose.
Oh, I think he made a good decision. He made a good decision. Oh, he would have been crucified in the dominant media, and
right,
he was very smart to let it go. And again, you can come back and you can refight the battles in new ways. But the key thing is that what goes on in Venezuela takes place by democratic vote. People actually get to decide themselves how they want the country governed, who they want to govern in various positions. And it's not a perfect system. There's no perfect system anywhere. But compared to the way things are run up here, Greg, and I watch them, and it just appalls me, the stuff that I see go on. And when I dig out information about just the terrible stuff that happens that goes completely unnoticed in the major media, it makes a travesty out of democracy. Where in Venezuela, it's not perfect, but it's the real thing.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you that it's not perfect. There's lots of problems still in Venezuela, and I write about some of them in my book as well. I talk about that, you know, there being an overdependence on Chavez, and I think the having this Chavez run a third term is actually a symptom of that problem. I don't think it's so much an issue of, you know, democracy in the sense that, you know, whether it's undemocratic or not for Chavez to run again. I think it's perfectly democratic. But I do think it's a problem for the Bolivarian movement to be so dependent on one individual, because after all, what should be the center is the political program and not an individual. And so my criticism there is it has to do more with the weakness of the movement itself, but not with the process, which is, I would say, still democratic.
Greg, I agree with you completely, and the U.S. history that I know, going back to George Washington, he could have been president for life, and even if he had an opponent, I think he easily could have won every time, and he set the precedent of maximum two terms. He did not want to run for a third term, so he stepped aside to let somebody else become president. I would say, given the way the U.S. has turned out, it was a good move. Heaven help us if George Bush could run for a third term, and they had no trouble stealing the first two. I'm certain they could easily do it again the third time, or as many times in the future as they wanted to. So it's a good idea that we can get past him. Very sadly, the alternative, I'm afraid, the way I assess things, isn't going to turn out much better. But he hasn't come in yet, so I'm willing to give the new guy a chance and let him prove me right or wrong, and I hope he proves me wrong. But again, Chavez, there's a real cult following supporting him. And I guess a big reason is, number one, he delivers, Greg. And number two, there's never been anything in the way of Venezuelan governance like him in the past, or in Latin America, for that matter.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and the thing is, he's a very charismatic leader, and one of the arguments that people bring for having, you know, him or allowing him to run again for a third term is that, you know, the Bolivarian project, which is to create 21st century socialism, is a very long-term project. Getting rid of poverty and creating a society that is truly egalitarian requires a lot of time. And so far, Chavez has been the only one who's shown to be capable of uniting a very fractured progressive movement in Venezuela. And therefore, this is the only opportunity for real change is to allow him to run again. And I think that's, you know, it's a pretty strong argument. But unfortunately, people should also think about, well, you know, what is the alternative? That is, you know, wouldn't it be possible to organize a movement that could win rather than an individual? And that discussion is being postponed by allowing Chavez to run again.
And, of course, one day there will be somebody after Chavez. Nobody lives forever, sure. So there'll be a new president one day. To me, the key is, regardless of how long Chavez stays president, is the people decide. There are democratic elections. The people make their choice. And if they want Chavez as their president, then why should they not have the right to have him? So my feeling is that way very strongly. And if he really lets them down grievously, then they can vote him out. And if he did, I'm sure that's exactly what would happen. But things have gone on pretty well under him. Again, not perfectly by a long shot, but they've gone on very well. And why spoil a good thing? Let's see how much more he can accomplish. He's still a fairly young man. He can go on. He can produce an awful lot of good things going forward. One thing that concerns me right now, Greg, is the state of the world economy. And sooner or later, this will touch Venezuela. It certainly is in declining oil prices. Yeah. What's going on? How much fear is there in the country as to how far oil prices may drop and how that will affect the Chavez program?
Well, it is a serious problem. I mean, and it's one that I have to say I didn't expect to become that serious so quickly because, the price of oil has been dropping so dramatically. I think it's coming as a surprise to almost every analyst out there. That, you know, in 1 year it drops from $140 to now around $40. I mean, that's unprecedented, that kind of a drop in something like 6 month period. And that is very dangerous for all oil producing countries because, they get a substantial amount of their revenue from there. And if that price stays so low, that's going to be quite a shock to the Venezuelan economy. And I'm truly worried about what that's going to mean. I think Chavez can, as a president, can survive it because he's done it before. But one also has to be aware that, Chavez's, how should I say, hardcore supporter base, I would say, is around 40% of the population. So that leaves another 20% or so that, are supporting him based on the fact that the economy is going well. And so that concerns me, and so they need to figure out a way to convince people that, opportunistic voters, so to speak, and, they exist everywhere. And I think they have to figure out a way to keep the Venezuelan economy and the population going despite this decline in oil prices. And I think Venezuela is not, unfortunately, prepared for that because it came as such a surprise that it dropped so dramatically in such short amount of time. So it's going to depend also a lot on OPEC and what OPEC is going to do. They're having a meeting next week and whether they can bring the price up at least a little bit again.
Oh, I think they'll cut. They'll probably have to cut, even though I guess they all cheat a little bit. But I've done an awful lot of writing, Greg, that I haven't sent you because it's unrelated directly to Venezuela, but on the global economic crisis. I've just become obsessed with that topic and the stuff that's going on here. I'm very critical of the policies that have taken place and the fact that criminal bankers have been bailed out with trillions of dollars. The latest figure that I've seen, either allocated or pledged, $8.5 trillion, Greg. $8.5 trillion. The U.S. national, that's over half of the U.S. national debt before they started handing out all of these trillions. And they're handing them out to criminals. This was criminal fraud conducted by these banks. They created these assets that turned out to be toxic. And they literally defrauded investors. And that's besides the subprime scandal where poor families were conned into taking mortgages that they didn't understand would have very substantial resets after initial very low teaser rates, and the rates got jacked up very, very high, which is the reason there's such a terrible foreclosure problem in the country. And of course, housing has just crashed, and it probably has a long way to go. And then you've got this terrible toxic asset problem that's contaminated the big banks, it's contaminated financial institutions all across the world, far less so in Venezuela, as I understand. It's been a very small problem in Venezuela, because right. I guess the banks have not gotten involved in this kind of stuff, except maybe to a modest degree. So Venezuela's problem is really falling oil prices,
right.
and certainly some effects from this terrible global crisis that I truly believe is unprecedented, just how bad it will be as it plays out in the months and probably years ahead. I don't think anybody can know, but it's extremely serious. I know Michelle Chostodowski calls it the worst economic crisis ever. It is really mammoth, and it will take an awful lot of individuals and companies down with it before it ends. And of course, it has to do a little damage down in Venezuela as well.
Yeah, I mean, Venezuela in that sense is lucky that it is managed to stay away from the financial crisis. But the oil price is really going to have its impact if it continues to decline as it has so far.
We have to take a break. Yeah, I'm very fearful about how low oil prices may go, Greg. But let's take a break, and we'll come back and finish up the hour. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Greg Wilpert. Greg, let me just take a moment and say what I neglected to say at the top of the hour. This week, for the first time, we're in our new time slot. We moved up an hour to 10 a.m. U.S. Central Time, and it's a one-hour program, and we're on Monday through Friday. For the time being, we'll be live Monday and Tuesday, and Wednesday through Friday, we will repeat programs. The program that you're listening to now will be repeated on Thursday. The Monday program will be repeated tomorrow. And when my co-host, Michelle Chostodowski, is able to get back to hosting probably early next year, he's been teaching, he's been world traveling, he's in Latin America right now, he will come back and we'll probably go at least 3 days live. But this is our new time slot. We're still archived. So people can listen live, they can go to the archives and so on. But let's finish up, Greg. The hour flies by as it always does. What else of importance can we pass on about Venezuela to listeners?
Well,
so we got elections, we got the referendum coming up. I mean, there's so much going on. I'm not certain if there's anything really prominent that we forgot to mention.
No, probably not. Well, the main thing, I guess, is probably the misconceptions that exist in terms of, you know, human rights in Venezuela. I actually just wrote a major expose of a Human Rights Watch report that Human Rights Watch did on Venezuela, which is just shocking in terms of its distortions and omissions and how misleading it is, because the Human Rights Watch of Venezuela compares favorably, the human rights record of Venezuela compares favorably with any country in Latin America or the United States. And the Human Rights Watch presents it as if there was a serious problem in Venezuela, and it's just so egregious. And I did an in-depth 24-page analysis of the 260-page analysis that Human Rights Watch did, and it just shows so many gaps and holes in it. It's ridiculous. So if anybody, you know, I hope nobody, people don't get misled or fooled by this report, because it's really ridiculous, and that they look also to my analysis if they run across that report.
You did an incredible job. You really took it apart. I wrote briefly about it. It was an atrocity. I mean, Human Rights Watch absolutely disgraced themselves. That they would be in the pocket of people who want to vilify Chavez. And, of course, knowing who funds them, I covered that in my article, the usual types that want to go after independent Democrats and Human Rights Watch. They've done it before, Greg. They've done it in other countries. And it really was a very despicable act that they did.
Yeah, I agree, and it's really a shame, because they sometimes do good work, and So it gets, now it gets more difficult to determine when they do the good work and when they do bad work.
Oh, absolutely. We're practically out of time. I want to mention your book again, Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, the History and Policies of the Chavez Government. And, Greg, you do such extraordinary work at Venezuela Analysis. Again, VenezuelaAnalysis.com. It's the value of the site, Greg, is because of the work that you do, and you really built an extraordinary site that I say it about global research, a treasure trove of information in general, and Venezuela Analysis is a treasure trove of information about what's really going on in Venezuela. My hat's off to you, Greg, and it was terrific having you back on again.
Okay, thank you. And, well, it's also thanks to the writers. I'm not doing it by myself, but thanks.
Oh, thank you, Greg. And we got to get you back, and we'll do this again as more things unfold in the country.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much, Greg. And we'll be archived the rest of the week, and we'll be back next Monday and Tuesday for more live programming. Please join us.